The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 366, recorded on October 15th, 2014.
Welcome to the 366th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 199th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Paul S. Novak.
And I am Jonah Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry.
Right.
And often includes other segments, but apparently not this week.
Not this week. And, you know, for several reasons. One, Paul has told me that he's going to be gone for 2 weeks as he comes to the East Coast and deals with family and stuff. So,
yes, I have to go and christen my godbabies.
So we're not gonna have him around, and I may just let the podcast simmer for 2 weeks or something. However, I do have some good news, and that we will have a third podcaster again.
Ooh, when is that happening?
Probably when you come back.
Fantastic.
So instead of having old people come for the 200th episode of Video Game Roundtable, we'll have new people.
Ooh, a special surprise third podcaster.
Well,
love it.
Technically, he's not a new person. The person who's going to be joining us is Devin Grimes, and he...
Well, you're not supposed to ruin the surprise by telling them.
No, well, I'm going to ruin the surprise because it's necessary. He used to write for Game Stooge, which this podcast was a part of before Game Stooge was shut down. And, he's getting interested in the video game industry again, so he's very keen on doing a podcast.
Fantastic.
So, and the thing is that, we do have a whole, Paul is mostly Nintendo, and I do a lot of Microsoft stuff. Not that I'm not, not that I don't have knowledge about the other consoles, but if you want me to talk about the 3DS or the Vita, I'll be like, I don't know. Especially the Vita, which Paul does not own, and I do not own. If we want to talk about the 3DS, Paul's perfectly willing to talk about that because he owns one. But we do have a gap right now, and I think that gap's shown for the past few weeks because there have been certain articles which we were not able to discuss in any great depth because we don't own those consoles.
So, okay.
Yeah. So he's going to be joining us when Paul returns.
And fantastic.
And right now, let's just go to what have you been playing. I'll go first on that. I finished playing Middle-earth Shadow of Mordor, and it's pretty good. I enjoyed the ending, although, a lot of people said it was short. I sort of agree, but there are other game modes, and there's still the collecting to go. And the fact is, the combat is so good, I don't mind waiting around and just killing orcs or taking over their minds and having them fight for me and that sort of stuff. So that's what I've been playing. How about you, Paul?
I've been playing a lot of Dungeon Keeper on iOS.
Really?
It's gotten better.
Oh, okay. So how's it
gotten? It's not fantastic, but I've reached a point in my horrible grinding that has gotten that has gotten it better.
Yeah. Well, you did mention a couple of weeks ago that they reduced certain timers, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, they reduced the timers that it took to like dig out your dungeon space, and they often run sales, for how much it costs to upgrade stuff, and it seems like there's an improved effort going on there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if I hadn't already been in the middle of it, I can't imagine spending money on it.
Well,
I don't even have like a guild room.
Well, if there's a non-Nintendo property that you love, it's Dungeon Keeper.
This is true. I also love BioShock, though.
Oh. Let me ask you a question. Did you finish the expansions to BioShock Infinite?
No, okay. I didn't even finish BioShock Infinite.
Oh, okay.
And mostly because there's no freaking map, so I get lost.
Well, they do have it's that. Like, well, you do have that path in which, you press it down and it shows you where you're supposed to go.
Right. If I wanted a really on-rails experience, that's what I would have purchased.
Well, you know what? Whenever I hold down the buttons to show the path to where I'm supposed to go, that usually allows me to go away from it because I know, you know, I'll explore and then I'll come back to it when I'm ready to move forward. So it's sort of like, well, if you want to go forward, it's that way. And I say, okay, thank you. I'm going to go that way instead because I want to see if there's any stuff over there. And I'll get back on the main path when I'm good and ready.
Yeah, I, you know, it's some well-meaning designer removed basically all HUD elements along with the map, and it's just like, yeah, I can't keep track of nothing. Like, you kind of doubled the problem by trying to fix it.
So by trying to increase immersion, you've lost immersion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You've gained frustration.
Anyway, we're moving on to game news, and, you know, I'm really getting tired of the Gamergate crap. So hopefully this will be the last we talk about Gamergate. So the first item is Sarkeesian cancels Utah State presentation following threats of shooting. And this comes to us from Game Informer. And for some reason, that info has disappeared.
I didn't do it.
I'm going to pause this for a moment. Feminist Frequency founder and pop culture critic Anita Sarkeesian was scheduled to speak last night at Utah State University. The presentation was canceled shortly before the event took place in the wake of a shooting threat. Sarkeesian said she canceled the talk not because of the threats, but because the university would not take certain security precaution. According to the Standard Examiner, which reported on the incident yesterday, the email threat warned of, quote unquote, the deadliest school shooting in American history. To be clear, I didn't cancel my USU talk because of terrorist threats, she said in a statement on Twitter. I canceled because I didn't feel the security measures were adequate. And I'm pretty sure you'll love this. According to a Utah State spokesperson, the school could not legally prevent students from bringing in concealed weapons.
What?
Yes.
That's not acceptable.
It's our great old, gun nut, open carry sort of crap, which says you can take guns into churches and all that stuff. I just find it weird that the school's not allowed to say, hey, you know what? On this premises, you can't bring in guns because, just the same way, a restaurant says no shirt, no service.
Is it a state school?
Yeah, it's Utah State.
Well, then they have every right to do that.
But no, the law says in Utah that you can't do that. And you're allowed to conceal weapons, apparently. So you can open fire on this one, Paul, so to speak.
You know, the ridiculous additional piece of this, you know, the way that Utah State is basically handling this, is really symptomatic of a larger problem. If somebody was making death threats against the head of BMW or, you know, mortgage bankers, or then, like, the world would be in, you know, up in arms. You know, we'd have psychologists talking about how our society has gotten so, you know, out of whack and sociopathicism, but it's just like, oh, because it has to do with women in games, it's not a real issue. And it's ridiculous that these poor people are fearing for their lives.
Well, let me put it a different way. Now, suppose there was a death threat against a speaker,
an Olympic swimmer.
Well, yeah, if an Olympic swimmer, you know, who's female, it doesn't really matter what sex. And they said the same thing. Oh, you know, well, I know you got death threats, but, you know, people can bring in concealed weapons if they want to. So, you know, what does that mean? That the swimmer has to have bodyguards with concealed weapons? You know, it's always fun to have crossfire. That never...
Oh, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what should happen. Dude, this is like the same thing that was on an episode of Arrow that I watched last night.
I don't watch Arrow.
It was like... No, it's just like a public rat. Like, it's a public event. And to blatantly ignore a death threat is extremely irresponsible.
Well, you know, the thing is that hopefully...
Your right to carry a weapon is not without limits. You only have rights in as much as they do not interfere with other people's rights of expectation of safety.
I'm just waiting for a shooting in Utah, you know, which is unfortunate, before they realize how idiotic it is, and they have to say the excuse, well, we don't not permit concealed weapons. How could we have possibly known if we allow people with concealed weapons, there might be a shooting?
And you know what? What really drives me insane about this is that I completely support the Second Amendment, but it's people like this who are abusing the right. It's like, I'm a reasonable person. I would know better than to walk into a daycare with a gun.
Oh, well, actually, you know, they're trying to walk in with AK-47s, you know. something that we didn't have. Something we didn't have in the 18th century, just so you know.
And no, it's not even about like the power of the weapon. It's about there are some places where weapons are just inappropriate. Yes, it's your right, yeah. But are you acting in a safe and sane manner? Of course not.
You know what these people really want? And I'm talking about people who want open carry. They want the ability to walk around with weapons, but not be in danger. Because I'll tell you something. If you look at the countries in which there's open carry of weapons, those are not places you'd want to live. Those are places with what we call warlords.
Yeah.
You know, where life is very forfeit. And the reason why kids have guns there is not because it's cool. It's because they might get shot. And they have to defend themselves. They have to defend themselves because, you know, you see these you know where ISIS is right now? You have a lot of people, civilians, who have to arm themselves because they're scared of ISIS. And by the way, we're getting way off track here, but one thing that people do not realize about ISIS is that all those people have American accents. You know, just a little hint there. So, you know, getting back to this problem, I mean, and what I love is that whenever Gamergate, some of these fanatics, and by the way, Gamergate is basically the Tea Party, except computerized. It's the same exact thing. They have this cause they're fighting for, but they're not fighting for that cause. They don't care about the cause that they say they're fighting for. You know? This entire thing about Gamergate was supposed to be video game journalism integrity, right? But, you know, the people who actually care about video game journalism integrity, you know, are leaving it in droves, and we'll get to that in the next item, which you might as well do right now, Paul, because it's related.
Former Gamergate member explains his departure, and this comes to us from NeoGAF. Quote, it actually took far, far longer than I'm comfortable with for this to sink into my thick skull. When you finally detach yourself from Gamergate and move away from the constant reinforcement the group provides that, no, we're doing the right thing, these are the bad guys, remember how bad they made you feel, we are doing the right thing, you look and see, holy shit. Quote, this really is a hate movement fueled by nutters. How did I get dragged into this? I'd implore Gamergate supporters to distance themselves from the tag and from the community and take a very good look at everything that's going on and all of the people who are being hurt. Are video game websites that we don't even visit worth people's lives being ruined? It's so easy to feel it's all just a game because we aren't the ones on the other end of the hatred. It's easy to point at someone and call false flag, but because we aren't the ones who are sitting there having people actively show up on our doorstep saying, come out and play, the ends do not justify the means. We don't need hashtag Gamergate to do good. There are a lot of people who want to achieve the same goals as us, but we are radioactive until we move away from hashtag Gamergate because of what it represents. We can't start enacting change when the people who actually could start making these changes happen to want nothing to do with us. I don't know who wrote this copy,
but it makes some salient point. It's a forum member at NeoGAF, and it's been making the rounds.
I wish our copy reflected that. But yeah, I mean, whoever this anonymous author is, like, they've made some fantastic points.
The author is a guy named B-L-Y-R. He's not a, you know, it's still anonymous, but it's a forum member who posts there. So, I mean, you know, it was not something that we didn't get into was that yet another female person was issued death threats to her home. And, you know, once again, she got the police involved. And, you know, there's something that these people don't understand is that, yeah, you could have GIFT, you know, Greater Internet Fuckwad Theory, you know, and think that you're anonymous and able to troll and able to send death threats. But the real world takes them seriously. And you know what? Yeah, let's see how you know, you're going to find your anonymity gone pretty quickly. And you're going to find yourself in a place where, let's just say, you don't want to drop the soap.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's a kind of ironic. I was just yesterday having a conversation with somebody, like, from a business. You go in, you sign into a virtual world, and you make some kind of comment just out of frustration. You know, just seeing that in text, a company has no idea whether or not to take you seriously. but it is, you know, incumbent upon them to police the chat of their users. So, you know, if some poor kid is like, oh, I'm having a horrible day, I'm going to kill myself, like, most major companies have a reporting structure, like, and a procedure for things that have to be followed. Like, they'll snag your IP address and call the police in your town to be like, hey, we've got a kid threatening to kill himself. And then 2 hours later, you know, cop's going to show up at your door just because you didn't think about what you were typing.
The other thing is that sports figures have do this a lot. And one of the things that a lot of people say to them is, you know what? Wait 10 seconds before you press enter on that Twitter post, you know, because you could say something that you don't want to say. And, you know, people have screen captures. And even if you delete that tweet, it's going to be there forever, you know, in one form or another.
Right.
You know, but like I said, you know, if you start screaming, well, I have the freedom of speech. No, you don't. People seem to be confused what that means, by the way. What it means, what freedom of speech means, is that the government can't jail you for something you said. Right.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. It doesn't mean you can walk around saying whatever you want with no consequences.
But it also does not mean you can threaten people and make death threats and all that, because
right.
then that's not freedom of speech.
Right. And again, the dividing line there is, yes, you can have – you can say whatever you want free of government intervention up until it encroaches on somebody else's right to have an expectation of safety and privacy.
The other thing is, you know, people don't understand that just because you have freedom of speech doesn't mean other people don't have freedom of speech.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, if you're upset at what people are saying about you, well, guess what? You invited on yourself and they're expressing their opinion to your opinion, and you can whine about it someplace else because no one's going to pity you.
Right. Like, you know, TV shows that got canceled because the stars.
Oh, those two guys. Yeah. On.
Yeah. What? Like what? Without getting into that whole thing, it's like, oh, we can't believe that they violated my First Amendment right to say whatever I want. I'm like, no, they're a business. The First Amendment has to do with the government taking action against you.
Yeah. And the thing is that if that was enforced that way, can you imagine people saying stuff on television and say, well, you can't fire me because I have First Amendment. And then the viewership goes down and the show is canceled. You know, QVC has an audience and they want the audience to stay. If they don't, if the audience goes away, they have no money. And just so you know, the QVC has a large gay population, gay viewership. You know,
I think you mean HGTV, and I didn't really want to get into this particular
QVC
part of the conversation.
HGTV.
No, it's the Home Improvement Channel.
Okay. I thought they were going to be on a show in which you buy stuff. Oh,
the Home Improvement Channel.
Oh, okay. Anyway, you know, it has what's it called? You're going to be insulting your population base. So,
right. So again, it's like we are not doing a good enough job teaching fundamental civics in our school system.
Especially when people, the scary part is those people are growing up to be politicians and passing laws in which you're allowed to carry concealed weapons into colleges.
That means before you qualify for office, like, they should make you pass a civics exam. How does our government work?
Yeah.
What is the point of the Supreme Court?
Because if a presidential candidate thinks that the Declaration of Independence was signed in the 15th century, then, you know.
I don't even know where that reference came from, but it sounds like one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard.
Well, you know. Well, Sarah Palin said that Paul Revere was trying to warn the British.
I'm sorry. At the moment you said the word Sarah Palin, I started laughing.
Well, she said that we were there.
I've been Pavlovianly conditioned.
Paul Revere was trying to warn the British.
Case in point, this woman should be having to pass a standard American history test.
Well, you know, her gotcha question was, "What do you read anything?" You know, so anyways, we're getting way off. This is not the politics podcast, although this does, you know, get into politics, Gamergate. So the thing is that, you know, it's interesting that Deadspin said that this was actually a view of the future for this sort of thing. You know, that this is the basic playbook that's been done in time and immemorial, right? But it's being brought into the internet space. And this is, you know, and it's sort of scary. I just hope that you know, geez, I know. I was about to say, I'm hoping that people on, you know, gamers and stuff are more savvy than this, but my brain stopped me right there and said, no, they're not. You know, and I'm starting to understand why people used to say, you know, children should be seen and not heard. And unfortunately, the internet puts everybody on the same level in terms of volume. So, you know, I'm guaranteeing most of these Gamergate people are under 25, if not under 22. I'm willing to bet you.
I have no idea how we would be able to confirm that.
It's just from dealing with college age students and being a college age student at one point in my life as well. And, you know, in which, you know, social graces are not fully formed even for them yet, you know.
Well, I mean, aside from the fact that we're imposing an artificial adolescence on our society, but that's a completely separate issue.
Yeah, this is getting really heavy. We're going to move on to the next item. But here, before I do, you know, just let us know what you think, you know. Actually, one little note is that there is a movement now called Stop Gamergate 2014. And there's also another movement in which people want to deal with journalism integrity. And, you know, that's been brought up something. You know, the issues that Gamergate could have been bringing up are not being brought up. For example, two nights ago, I think it was, Blizzard brought out one of the chief writers from GameSpot to talk about how great their expansion, you know, the latest World of Warcraft expansion is, you know, and people have to think, wait a minute, this is a review site. This is a video game journalism site, and they're being used as shills for Blizzard. There is something wrong there. Is GameSpot going to be pressured to give the expansion a really high review because they're the ones who are pimping it up at this show? You have to think about that.
Yeah, it sounds like they, you know, it sounds like they'd be taking money for these positive reviews, or at the very least, encouraged to give positive views with the appeal that comes with speaking at public events.
Well, here's the thing. They're getting money for being at the public event. They're not doing this for free. Or if they're doing it for free, they're getting access, you know?
Right.
But the problem is that are they now pressured to give a high review? You know, I would respect GameSpot if when the expansion came out, they gave it like a 6.5, you know, it's okay. Blah, blah, after they pimped it up, because they're saying, well, you know, that was our PR. This is our review section. And we're making sure that, you know, we're not going to give it a high review just because we pimped it up. I mean,
well, the problem with internet video game journalism is that it's twofold, you know, and it's a similar problem faced by, you know, movie critics like Siskel and Ebert. You know, Siskel and Ebert were a product that was there to rate movies, but why would they start handing out like massively negative reviews? So they basically just didn't provide any review for things that they felt were below a certain standard. So I think the lowest that they gave anything, you know, was like a median grade. And
hold on, no.
I think we need to get to
the problem with critics is that, and I don't know if you know this about film critics.
I was making a salient point, but okay.
Is that they're sent junkets. They're sent, you know, they're sometimes flown out to places to, you know, to see the movie, and they're given gifts and all that stuff. And, you know, and then they come back and they give it a high review because no one cares, you know. Because these are not big reviewers like Siskel and Ebert. They're small reviewers, but they're the ones you see on the advertisements, you know. So I'm sorry. What was the point that you were going to make?
Well, the point that I was making was that as far as internet video games journalism goes, you know, running a blog is incredibly demanding. Like it's in the yellow journalism stages where the only thing that they care about is generating as much content as they possibly can. So that's when you're going to get inflammatory, you know, web page articles and really decisive game reviews, whether or not they're completely accurate. Yeah. Because they're driving back money.
Well, you know,
to the owners of those sites.
Yeah. I mean, it is a very, you know, and the thing is that there we haven't, you know, the video game industry is still young. You know, I would say it's sort of like the 30s for film, you know.
It's older than most of its fans, unfortunately.
Well, the thing is that, you know, it's sort of like in the 30s and 40s in which they're still trying to figure out stuff, you know. Eventually, you know, you sort of had a format, you know, we don't have the real critical thinkers yet. I mean, we do, but we don't have them as major voices. You know, if you were to name who's the biggest video game reviewer out there, people would have to think about it very hard. And, you know, they would probably just say someone they've read a lot, you know, and they sort of basically know their name. And that's it. I mean, even if I were you to ask me, I would say, well, Ben Crowshaw, but he does a comedic videos about sites, and he's usually negative because it's funny, you know. So, like I said, it's a long way to go, and we're going to move on to the next item. Unreal Bioshock developer Digital Extremes sold to Chinese companies, and this comes from GameSpot. Digital Extremes, the Canadian developer that worked on Epic Games, on various Unreal Tournament games, and the multiplayer mode for Bioshock 2, has been sold to a pair of Chinese companies. Most recently, Digital Extremes launched free-to-play shooter Warframe for PC, Xbox One, and PlayStation 4. According to CEO James Smalls, we are thrilled with the potential to work with partners who share a philosophy on the future of gaming and how we're approaching it. This partnership will empower us and to continue making Warframe bigger and better with full control over its destiny. The acquisition has not yet closed and is subject to several conditions. One of the conditions is granting exclusive rights to Perfect Online to publish Warframe in mainland China. That country recently lifted its 14-year ban on consoles, and the Xbox One went on sale in the region just last month, becoming the first console legally sold in China since 2000. And we'll get back to that point in a second. Digital Extremes is not the first North American company to have sold controlling interest to a Chinese firm. In 2011, Chinese internet company Tencent acquired a majority stake in League of Legends developer Riot Games. A year later, Tencent bought 40% stake in the Gears of War creator Epic Games. Digital Extremes also developed Star Trek, The Darkness 2, and the PC version of Homefront. So, what's funny is that legally sold, because, you know, you did have those knockoffs, you know. Oh, I'd like to buy a Nintendo.
Right.
So, this strikes me as interesting because we like to think as the U.S. as, you know, a major, you know, the country in terms of business and finance. But the fact is, you know, we're losing money hand over fist, and other companies and countries are moving in and buying the property because they're richer, you know, basically.
Or is it because they're richer or because they control the distribution channels to their country?
That too. That only makes them richer. You know, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I'm not alarmist, like, oh no, China's buying everything. The fact of the matter is, we're selling because we can't afford it, you know? And I think that sort of speaks to our economy in large, but let's remain in the video game industry, you know, because making video games is expensive. I mean, big video games, even small games, you know. And the fact is, you know, one of the things he said is we're going to make Warframe bigger and better because they're going to get paid more. You know, they're going to get more money to do this because this might be a secret, but China has a really, really big population, you know, who will spend for this stuff.
Well, it's not even it's a matter of fast nickels and slow dimes, right? So if you can get the cost down enough and you can collect more, you can collect less money from more people and end up with a greater total.
Yeah. So I have to think about the future because one thing is that, you know, the Japanese video game market is shrinking and shrinking because they simply can't afford the budget for the games, you know. While U.S., you know, they have some mega companies which make really high-priced games, but a lot of the most innovative stuff are indie developers. So it makes me wonder where China is going to fit into all of this.
We shall see.
Yeah. Anyways, we're going to move on to some articles in which you're going to have a firm grasp on, because we're going to go into your arena now, Paul. And go ahead, take the first one.
Games driving nearly all of Google Play's revenue growth in the U.S. And this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. Games continue to account for, quote, the lion's share of revenues in Google Play Store in the third quarter of 2014. The trend continues as games fueled growth on Google Play worldwide, spurred on by big gains in the U.S. and South Korean markets, where, quote, games were responsible for nearly all Google Play's third quarter revenue and growth in each country, according to a new white paper from the research firm App Annie. App Annie specifically pointed out the success of strategy games like Game of War, Fire Age, Boom Beach, and Clash of Clans, and also noted the success of more casual fare like Kim Kardashian's Hollywood and Bubble Witch Saga 2. The top five countries for Google Play revenue were Japan, US, South Korea, Germany, and Taiwan. Despite Google Play's dominance in downloads, Apple continues to drive more in revenue. In the same quarter of 2014, the iOS App Store's revenue was around 60% higher than Google Play's.
I will note that they also said elsewhere in the article, under a lot of convoluted stuff, that Google Play exceeded Apple's games, right? The thing about Apple iOS App Store is, I think, doesn't that include the music too? I mean, there's a lot of music downloads and also general apps. You know.
Yes, but I'm fairly certain that App Annie would separate out the different distinctions, because there's, you know, there's iTunes for music, and then everything else is labeled as an app.
Right.
If it's not music.
So when you're making your games, I mean, I notice, you know, most of the stuff that you do are for this realm, you know, Apple and Facebook and Google. So what is your perspective on this?
It's been my experience that Apple is much more stringent about its quality standards for submission. And so it doesn't surprise me that they still contain a higher market share, aside from their endless treadmill of hardware releases, but mostly because they are doing more to ensure the standards of their apps as opposed to Google Play. I mean, getting through Google's submission process takes like a tenth the time as it does of Apple's.
Wow,
and it's really because the standards are much higher.
By the way, speaking the what's called the iPad Air 2 was revealed earlier today, I believe, or at least information about the iPad Air 2. So yeah, they're constantly bringing out new hardware. You know, we're gonna move on to the next item, which is also related to this. Mobile spending driven by 35 to 44 year olds. And this also comes to us from Games Industry Biz. A new study from Unity-owned mobile gaming firm EveryPlay released today is shedding some light on just who is spending what in the mobile game market. According to the company's survey of 3,055 people, the most lucrative audiences for mobile games are older, male, and deeply invested in the games they play. The study found that the average money spent per month on mobile games peaks at $6.07 in the 35 to 44-year-old demographic, while the next most lucrative crowd is being the 45-plus crowd at an average monthly spend of $4.80. The 18 to 24-year-old set was the least lucrative of the games surveyed, with its members bringing in just $3.75 on average per month. EveryPlay also found that men were more invested in mobile games, spending an average of $5.63 opposed to a $3.50 monthly spend for women. Among all mobile gamers, the average monthly expenditure was about $4.50. As might be expected, those who played the most also paid the most, and those who played less than an hour a week averaged just $0.66 on a monthly basis, while those averaging 10 or more hours per week went through an average of $15.50 on mobile games each month. However, 59% of all mobile gamers reported not spending a dime on the hobby, so those averages were raised significantly by a top-heavy group of quote-unquote whales, or people who spend more than $50 a month. By the study's definition, they make up less than 1% of the total gamer population, but account for 29% of mobile gaming revenues. So I know that you've absorbed this information.
Yeah, this is absolutely nothing surprising to anybody who makes games. But it seems that with a number of top heavy, highly engrossed, you know, games like Clash of Clans or Candy Crush Saga, that there's going to be, you know, appeal to people with more disposable income, more time with the phone in their hands, who don't need to get anybody else's permission to spend $5.
You know, they also noted in the article, this is a quite long article, that the number one thing attraction in a game, in a mobile game, for that demographic, the 35 to 44-year-old graphic, was social networking, that they wanted to be able to compare scores with friends and, you know, post their scores on Facebook and stuff like that.
All right, because we have a very disenfranchised age group that has been kind of left to twist in the wind and not really achieve the kind of success as their predecessors under older economy standards. So they're fulfilling that need virtually and being like, you know, you can't say, well, I have a bigger house or a better car now, but you'd be like, oh, I beat you in Clash of Clans.
I mean, when you're part of a development team, you know, does any of this stuff come up, you know, in terms of a goal? You know, I'm pretty sure the social networking part does.
I think that possibly more interesting to our listeners is the fact of metrics and how closely it, you know, it looks to how much is each person spending per month. And so, you know, a $6 per person per month figure is like insanely high. Like, it sounds like absolutely no money, but it's ridiculously high. Like, you're most of the time you're lucky if you break a dollar per person per month. And it's really kind of fascinating just to see how the spending habits of the once coveted 18 to 24 year old market has brought in the least numbers on these particular platforms, only because we've lowered that generation's expectation of what they, you know, would get versus what they have to pay for. And that's all basically been done through freemium models. We've raised an entire generation of gamer who thinks it's absolutely okay to never spend a dime on a game.
I don't know.
They, you know, just come from nowhere.
Or maybe they're playing console games while, you know, adults don't have the, well, I think, you see, the thing is that I think adults don't have this the amount of time to invest in a long game, you know, like a console game, and just want, you know, short bursts, you know, which I love in a mobile game, you know, in which there's something addictive about it, but I can just stop, you know, something like Fruit Ninja, in which you're trying to beat your previous score. It's a very simple mechanic. You're just brushing your fingers across the screen, you know, and it's a 90 second, you know, experience that has a lot of to it. You know, I just think a large part of it is adults want smaller chunks, you know, than gamers do, who want 20-hour gaming experiences, you know.
Well, I mean, I know that was certainly the case for me when I went back to grad school. You know, I went from being able to spend, you know, 120 hours on Final Fantasy to being able to spend like
Final Fantasy.
Yeah, to being able to spend like, you know, 5 minutes a day on Treasure Island by Zynga. I mean, so as you grow up, you have less time. So that might be part of the reasoning for this disparity in spending. But I do think that younger age group is just like, well, I don't want to pay money for anything because I don't have to. I'll just move on to the next thing and use up all their free content.
I also wonder if
there's much less gaming loyalty there.
I wonder if also, you know, I'm thinking about the 45 plus crowd, and I'm wondering how many of them were gamers before they got their mobile phone, and then someone introduced them to Candy Crush, and suddenly they started, you know, say, hey, this mobile gaming is pretty fun, you know?
You know what? I think that gamers in those higher age ranges will more likely stick with the game, and again, part of the reason for more spending, because they don't want to have to learn a new system or start over. It's like, we've done that so many times. I'm just going to stick with Candy Crush because I know it makes me happy, as opposed to moving on to whatever other hot new match 3 there might be.
So here's a question. When you're in a development group, how much are you hoping that you might hook a few whales, you know, one of those people who get so into your game, they just spend a metric crap ton of money on it, you know, what's called on DLC and stuff like that?
Well, my particular, you know, viewpoint is always that if I make a good game, the whales will come.
Okay, whale bait.
You know, I mean, not just that, but it's like, if you provide people a quality piece of entertainment, they'll pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, if you produce a shit movie, no one's going to come see it. If you write a terrible television show, no one's going to watch it. You're not going to sell ad space. If you make a terrible video game, people will spend about 3 seconds on it and then move on to something else, because there is more entertainment content being consumed at this point today. Just today, there has been more entertainment content produced than I could consume personally in a year. Let alone, you know, stretching that out over a lifetime. I mean, think of every television show that was aired today. Think of every book that was published.
Hmm. It's food for thought, and, you know, certainly.
There's more content to be absorbed than there is life in which to absorb it.
Yeah. So anyways, we're going to move on to reader feedback. Go ahead, Paul.
From Alphashard at Gamergate. Oh, what a clustered duck. Companies need to stay out of politics, and people need to keep their personal lives out of the media and business worlds. Why are these people failing to learn these lessons? Not to mention the whole mob mentality of jumping on a bandwagon that they have no business getting involved in the first place. No wonder I'm an escapist. I had thought that the name Gamergate was a company until I read this story, not on a continuation of the Watergate meme.
Now, before you move on, actually, there was an online game store called Gamers Gate, but it's no longer around. It's funny. I thought it was still open. Maybe there's a coincidence that they just couldn't do business anymore because they got some product confusion.
Probably not. I miss Funko Land. I agree with Paul. Well, you should, Alpishard. I'm usually right. I agree with Paul. You shouldn't add gate to the end of every scandal. It makes it hard to differentiate from real things that have gate in them, like the Brandenburg Gate or the Golden Gate. At Capcom, I know they are in the business to make money, but I've always hated this mentality. The idea that if it doesn't make 2 million, sell 2 million copies, it isn't worth bothering with this is a terrible thing. There have been games that did better over their lifetime than when they initially launched. Some games take time to build up their popularity, and this needs for them to be blockbuster sellers doesn't generate quality. There are many AAA games that have sold millions, and I have no intention of ever buying or playing. This is the mentality that killed the original Sierra games, and with them coming back, I don't want to go through all that again.
Well,
and, you know, just from my point of view, it's the same thing with the film industry. I mean, for example, Hocus Pocus didn't do very well at the box office when it came out, but that movie's 20 years old, and it still gets played every year. There's continuing value.
I will have you know, I saw it on launch day back in 93 with my partner at the time. They loved it
because
they're huge Bette Midler fan. I also like Bette Midler, but I wasn't as enchanted with Hocus Pocus. So.
I mean, I watched it last night. So it's like...
It's becoming a thing now for Halloween, I noticed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just like, you know, The Nightmare Before Christmas was fantastically expensive, but looking at the life cycle of this piece of property that has been around for, 20 years now, again?
Well,
you know, it kind of offsets that. And so to say that, like, you have to sell 2 million copies in your first year or we're not making a sequel is kind of ridiculous.
That's the entire point. You know, they're talking about a sequel here, not talking about the game itself, which may make money over a period of time, but by the time it makes 2 million...
Right, you know, but they're judging the first one as having been a failure because it didn't sell 2 million copies in the first quarter.
Well, do you really want a sequel to The Nightmare Before Christmas? Really? See? That's the problem.
I don't care for Tim Burton's lack of changing art style.
Well, actually, like I said, that was based on a Tim Burton poem. It's actually Henry Selick who directed and wrote that film. It's called Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas because it's based on his poem. So
anything attached with Tim Burton's name has the same visual aesthetic that I've grown weary of over the last 20 years.
Okay, moving on.
At Mario Clones, there was a similar joke in Sierra's Leisure Suit Larry, where if your character died and you restarted, they showed a cutscene of a new Larry being made and put back in place. So that's an interesting game concept to imagine your character is going through.
I forgot all about that. Yeah, they did. He came out of a mold.
Oh, that's gross.
You came out of a mold. No, you know what I'm talking about. You pour in something.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, yeah. The same way you happen to pour silicone into a mold and happen to get a particularly shaped object.
Okay, we're not going there, Paul.
I'm just saying. Like, yeah. So, I mean, molding Leisure Suit Larry people is really much more creepy than the Mario clone thing.
Okay.
Ew. At the question of the week, my favorite Saturday morning cartoon would have to have been, Dungeons and Dragons. Oh, good choice. You have nice taste. I love Super Friends and the Amazing Spider-Man, who was teamed up with Iceman and Firestar. No,
Firestar.
Okay. It was Spider-Man and his Amazing Friends. The Amazing Spider-Man was a different cartoon. But yes, it's Iceman and Firestar. I had to use a site to remember what cartoons were on Saturday mornings as opposed to weekday afternoons or mornings. So I can't seem to find when I watched the Silverhawks, Thundercats, or G.I. Joe.
Those are midday things.
Those are all afternoons. Yeah. Syndicated cartoons, which I thought were in the morning. There are also just as many to list, but those were very memorable, were the Gummy Bears, Garfield, Kissy Fur. Oh, I hated Kissy Fur. And the Smurfs.
I love the Gummy Bears.
I have to agree with Jonah. I know. I have the gummy bears on DVD. I have to agree with Jonah, and okay, now you're losing your points, Alpha Shard. I do remember watching Smurfs mostly to get to whatever was after it, and I didn't stick to just one channel. It was a very warm and fuzzy nostalgic memory of a tradition that is a shame has seemed to come to an end. I was like Jonah as well. After watching the cartoons, I would be ready to go out and play.
And the thing is that, I'm not sad for myself, but I'm sad because kids are not getting that warm and fuzzy feeling. They're going to have 20 years later in which they remember watching Saturday morning cartoons, you know, no matter how treacly they were, and then going out and playing on a Saturday. You know, that's what I think they're missing.
No, I want to watch the cartoons on Saturday morning with my candy cereal, goddammit, because I don't want to get out of bed.
Ooh, the candy cereal. That was the most important part of watching a Saturday morning cartoon. You had to eat it with Trix or Lucky Charms or something like that, you know, while.
And it was basically because our parents worked hard all week, and so if they slept until 9 or 10 and didn't have to worry about us, it was like, thank God.
Yeah.
At the third question of the week, I still play the Nintendo DS. I love all the RPG games. And the old nostalgic games that I can play on it. I'm very into Professor Layton games, so that's another one for Powell.
Okay, from Arthur V. EA's eternal struggle against its own credibility. When Battlefield 4 came out, I was lucky enough to be at a university and did not buy it at launch. I pre-ordered Battlefield 3 and spent the first day trying to get into a game, so I'm glad I missed their second fiasco. DICE needs to stop rushing their games out the door, especially considering that the Battlefield series have a terrible single-player component which cannot compensate for the lack of multiplayer, unlike Call of Duty. At the cute terrors of Nintendo. According to the original Mario manual, Bowser turned all the citizens of the Mushroom Kingdom into blocks. Basically, Mario rescues the princess as an accomplished mass murderer. In fact, Nintendo is full of creepy things which would make the Western audience cringe in fear. Dead Pokemon, Silent Hill-like Zelda dungeons, and getting Zelda's ultimate reward right in the dungeon she was kept in. Their early games were as good for kids as Grand Theft Auto. So, I did not know that all the citizens were turned into blocks, and that's when you're jumping and breaking those blocks, you're killing them?
I don't really remember it that way. I think it was that he turned them into something other than themselves.
Because I know when...
But yeah, I remember that. I mean, that was never part of the narrative that was related to me as a, 7-year-old game player.
Well, they said the original Mario, so I'm guessing they mean the Japanese game. I do remember.
Or they might be meaning the original Mario Brothers, in which they're not in the Mushroom Kingdom. They're in the sewers beneath Brooklyn. Yeah.
I do remember in Sonic that whenever you destroyed one of the robotic animals, the animal that was trapped inside came out and was very happy.
Right. Anyway. Absolutely.
At the question of the week, the 3DS is still my favorite. I don't play small iPhone games. I have KOTOR on the iPhone, but it gets continuously interrupted by various notifications and calls, which make me lose my progress. You don't say, like when Paul gets a call and puts me on, and gets me automatically put on hold.
I have no control over that.
Yeah, I think you enjoy it. Getting a call and knowing that I'm on the other end waiting, drumming my fingers, waiting for you to... Anyways, look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy feedback, so leave us comments on our blog at gamingpodcast.net. Also, hit us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast, the forums at gamingpodcast.net/forum, or send us your comments to fans@gamingpodcast.net. Subscribe to us on iTunes and leave some iTunes comments because we need iTunes. So, anyways, we're probably not going to see you. Who knows? You know, it may not be with Paul, maybe with someone else, but Paul will not be here for the next 2 weeks. So either there's nothing or...
Well, you're not allowed to do the 200th episode without me because I think at that point I would just piss on your shoes.
Oh, okay. And that's kind of a remarkable accomplishment since you're in L.A. Or even even if you were just in Long Island, that would be an incredible...
it's all about arcing.
So you know what? Leave us some reader feedback and from someone other than Alpha Shard, Arthur V, or Powell Pretke, or some of the older people who've been, in terms of listening to this podcast, not necessarily age, who've been around since episode one of the Video Game Roundtable, And, slowly but surely, in like a couple of months, we're going to have number 400 of the gaming podcast. You know, we're at 366. That's only 34 away. So that's 3/4 of a year, basically.
Three quarters of a year.
Yeah. So anyways, thanks for listening, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Bye, Bonds.